Okay, hello, and welcome to episode 51 of Dano Says So, brought to you by Trust Records as part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. This is the first episode we've run of the show since June 20th, almost 5 months. And my hope is that simply by virtue of his vocation and the life he's lived, today's guest might break up the rhythm we've sort of established here and come at us from sort of a mindset and a life view that is completely outside my own understanding, which would be exciting. Jim McSorley, I know him as Knocko Nolan, is a veteran of both the New York and Los Angeles police departments. He's worked as a beat cop. He's worked in plain clothes. He's worked Vice, Cracks, the Career Criminals Unit. He was part of a joint FBI task force against terrorism. He currently holds the rank of detective supervisor for the LAPD. These things, in and of themselves, make him an exciting get. Knocko Nolan, thank you for doing this.
It's my pleasure, Dano. I loved when I read that invite. It really got me excited. So this is really, really looking forward to this, outside of my norm. So cool. Very cool. Thank you.
Have we crossed paths since the pandemic started, or would it be like the last? Or would it be like the last Chiners Club shows before that?
I think it might have been Circle Jerks, right up in
at the Palladium. You're right.
No, not the Palladium.
Oh, no, Pappy and Eric.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Well, right off the bat, I'm off my notes. There we go.
It's all good.
Okay. You know, when I was reading that bio, and it shows a lot of different mileage in what I perceive as being a lot of heavy, heavy work. The one thing that jumped out at me and that I left out is the thing I want to ask you about first. And that's that in your bio, I read about time in a special victims unit and investigating crimes against children. What all did that entail?
That entailed we were in charge of investigating physical abuse and sexual abuse against juveniles. So it's below 18. And so it's homicide on down. So from killing your kid to slapping them around to raping them. So it was like what it sounds, horrendous. Probably one of the most rewarding and worst assignments I've ever had, due to the fact that dealing with the criminal justice system and rape victims, I mean, it's been in the zeitgeist, you know, for during this whole Me Too era, is just come across a lot of resistance in the criminal justice field. It's the preponderance of the evidence to get a conviction is very, very high. As we know, victims of sexual assault, it's almost worse than murder. Because if you murdered, you don't know. You're already dead. When you're a victim of abuse, especially by at the hands of a family member, and I mean, you take that to the grave. That's just on your mind, I'm sure, every day, and it just affects you, and it just has a very huge lift mentally. I mean, it's crushing to hear, to have interviewed kids that were, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old being brutalized by family members. It was the worst crime imaginable. I mean, there's a reason why pedophiles are targeted in prison. It's like, okay, you're in a prison, everyone's done dirt, but everyone knows, even in the criminal underworld, you don't mess with kids, you don't mess with someone's family. And if you do, you're going to pay the price while you're inside prison. I don't condone the death penalty or, you know, street justice per se. I mean, I don't, but I understand, you know, why they targeted was they truly are the worst of the worst.
How do you preserve any kind of emotional remove or any kind of objective distance when you're investigating things?
You really don't. I mean, you take it to heart every day with a heartbreak. And when you go home, you try to distance yourself, I mean, but you're really fooling yourself. It's you're not. I mean, I had a very limited tour and that assignment because of that. It was very frustrating to have the main reason was to have these kids, you know, break down and open up their heart and tell you exactly what happened, and to take that to the district attorney's office and not have them prosecute that case, to go back to the kid and tell them that this person that brutalized them is not going to be convicted of this. I mean, it was horrendous. I couldn't do it for very long. The people that do it day in and day out for many years, my hat goes off to them. It's just very, very a frustrating assignment. But when we did get someone and they did, you know, multiple decades, extremely rewarding. But still, it's not like you're giving yourself high fives. The damage is done. I mean, you're just glad that hopefully, you know, that this person's never going to see the light of day. But there's no winners in that assignment, really.
It seems to me like it would be almost impossible to avoid a really unique cocktail of heartbreak and rage. I mean, congratulations on making it through.
Yeah. The rage was definitely there, probably manifested itself in drinking and other self-destructive behaviors at a thankfully, in the past. And it was a horrendous time in my career. But thankfully the squad I was working with, the guys, I mean, when we weren't working, you know, just, you know, actively, you know, in the midst of an investigative assignment, the guys itself, oh my God, I had a great squad. We busted each other's balls nonstop. We laughed. We had a tight crew, and I worked with some phenomenal guys, and that regard was awesome. And the people around you make it worthwhile. So I had a great, great squad of people. So yeah, that, as I'm thinking back at that, you know, I kind of, that's like a dark period of my career that I kind of put in the closet. But thinking back, I met some wonderful people and dedicated, really dedicated people that I just have the utmost respect for.
I knew you socially before I knew you were in law enforcement. In fact, it kind of caught me off guard when I found that out, and it challenged some of my perceptions and prejudices about mm-hmm. the field. That said, you started off as a beat cop, as everyone does, correct? It's academy, and then yep. it's working a beat. So at that point, it's not in as heavy, heavy investigative work, and a lot of what I perceive is really traumatic work, and it's more of a brave new world. What about your upbringing, and what about your life attracted you to the field?
You know, it's in Dan, it's in the lineage. I mean, you know, being an Irish American yourself, we're a protective clan. We're there mm-hmm. to fight or break up fights. You know, we're there to create chaos or restore order, and you know, kind of depends on what side you're on. You know, it's a rebel lineage. So with that said, it's kind of strange that there's a lot of rebels that find their way into either the armed forces or law enforcement or something in the first responder thing. Mm-hmm. So we walk the line, but then while we're in it, it's kind of a dichotomy that we're kind of a disruptive force at the same time and want to work outside those lines. It's a real yin and yang. So I come from a long line of veterans where I was taught that you're either part of the problem or you're part of the solution. So I wanted to be a part of the solution and bring order to chaos, and didn't like seeing my, you know, the places where I lived deteriorating and being destabilized by whatever means that was at the time. So I was taught, take it to them. And so police work is a great tribal existence, kind of like being in a band. I was in a band too when I was in my teens, and you got a group of guys and you're having fun, but at the same time, like I mentioned, other squad, you're doing great work, and at the same time you're outdoors and you're doing work that really means something, you're getting paid a decent wage. So I was like, I'm in. This is what I was meant to be. I was always a protector of my crew growing up, and that just translated into the profession I'm in. I've always been in small specialized units with a good group of guys that are hard-nosed and utmost professionals that take their craft very seriously. So this line of work, I don't know if you pick it or it picks you, but it's just in the blood for me.
There's two things I hear there that have me scratching my head, and not to the positive or the negative, but wow, I've got to wrap my brain around. And is that the last thing I would have ever expected you to tell me is that it correlates directly to your rebellious nature or to your rebellious youth. I mean, you can understand why that maybe wouldn't strike me as linear. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe you, but I did not see that coming. So that's interesting. It makes me think for you, and you don't strike me as someone who's particularly vulnerable to the opinion of others, but we know each other through, you know, these big times and small rooms in a very specific culture. Has it been difficult at any point in your life that what you do for a living is almost uniformly looked on negatively in that culture?
Probably in my 20s, you know, when, you know, you're kind of a little bit more secure and you're trying to find your place in life and, you know, your identity, and, you know, you're still honing yourself. But through the years, no, not really. I mean, I chalk that up to my dad. He had a long group of friends from all walks of life, you know, priests, punks, Hell's Angels, and everything in between there. So I knew there were people that when I presented themselves, they just knew me as law enforcement, as a detective. But once they got to know me, they understood where I was coming from. I was approaching it from a good place. And whatever thoughts they had of previous encounters that were negative, I understood. I mean, if I knew they legitimately got harmed or screwed over, I'm like, hey, I'm the first one to acknowledge that I work with some phenomenal people out of Saints. And I worked with some people that I wouldn't trust them alone in the room with my girl. I mean, you know, it's just a, it's an organization filled with humans. So you've got 10% that are saints and 10% that are Satan. And then everyone else is in between that kind of swims in the middle and does what they have to do. And just average, ordinary folks. So what other people think of me, you know, if they think I'm great, fantastic. If they don't, you know, give me a chance to prove you wrong. And if you still think, just because of what I do, you know, defines me, you know, we'll agree to disagree and we move on. And I just try to find the commonalities of people. There's so many, we have way more in common than we have not in common. And that's just like one little strike. And then I'll show you, I have, you know, 20 other positives that we'll agree upon. So I try not to look at the differences and just find the commonalities.
Well, one thing that what you're saying makes me think of is that from your perspective, I suspect that the reaction to the negative, or that the painting of the police with a very wide brush, right, seems imbalanced, seems not representative of the numbers, that for every 1,000, you know, cops who have a million things to be proud of, there's someone who's done something truly atrocious. Mm-hmm. That probably seems unfair, but something I would ask you about, do you think that maybe that disproportionate reaction or that inaccurate perception comes from the fact that you do a job that is capable of exercising a great deal of power over people that virtually no other career does? In other words, you know, an asshole who runs a pizzeria or a movie theater or drives an Uber is a lot less intimidating to me or inhibiting to me than an asshole police officer.
Absolutely. I mean, it's our Constitution was based on revolting, rebellion from illegal search and seizure, the Constitution of a freedom of assembly and the freedom of speech. So if you have someone, you encounter someone that's depriving you of those rights, I mean, that's the core of our U.S. citizens and what we believe in. And if you have someone doing the opposite of that, it's natural to have a pushback. So I get that. We're the most visible form of government. And people that are in certain neighborhoods might encounter us more than people in neighborhoods like you and I probably live in South Bay and Orange County, where you're just going through your normal existence of, you know, going to work to and from, and you're not in a densely packed, housing project or what have you, with a lot of time on your hands, and that you might be targeted due to the way you look or where you live due to since it's a high crime area. So I understand where people are coming from when they're dissatisfied with us and paint us in a certain light. And, you know, it's based on facts and it's a lot of validity to it. The only thing I could do is do the best I can every day out in the street, acknowledge that past and those facts, and try to change that person's opinion and show them that where myself and the people that I'm working with in my immediate grasp that I'm in charge of, that we're not that, and we can do better. And that's one of the core values of my department is quality through continuous improvement. So every day is a chance when I interact with someone to improve their view of law enforcement. So I can only be responsible for myself and the guys around me.
It's interesting. This plays into what I hope will take up a large part of the second part of this interview. I'm going to circle back to something else that just has to do with your career timeline before we start really biting into some of the things that you just said. And that is, I was wondering, was it easier earlier on? And then with advancement, do hairier assignments lead to a bigger load psychologically and maybe a heavier sense of responsibility? Or is police work? And from day one, it's kind of a heavy gig.
Whew, that's a good question. Trying to think back from, you know, 20, I mean, I've been doing this for, you know, almost 3 decades now. And I think just as time goes on, you learn how to get more comfortable in your skin. And, you know, humans, we just do things through repetitions. You know, it's like weightlifting. The more you reps you get in, the easier it is. So in your 20s, and probably by the 50 year of your career, you start up slowly, you know, you think you have a good grasp of things. And then you get year 10, and then you're like, yeah, I'm ready for anything. And then kind of by year 15, you start questioning, like, wow, was there everything I was doing in my 5th and 10th year mark, was that I doing it right? Or maybe I could do it better. Or, you know, times are starting to change within that decade. Let me refine some things. So for myself personally, I just find myself on a quest of always improving. I think I'm a good cop with a lot to learn still. I never stop learning. I try to think of myself as a lifetime student and teacher, trying to give back to the organization and the people I'm with, you know, by letting them learn from the example, things I've done in the past that were right and wrong. And then at the same time, try to learn from others. So Yeah, that's kind of a long answer to, I think.
you and I decide the length of this thing, so we're good. Have you had to bury a lot of people that you've worked with? And you know, if so, does that ever, you ever acclimate to that?
Yeah, it was a lot due to a good amount, I would say, to suicide.
Really?
And then, yeah, that was more suicide than line of duty deaths. And, you know, but a death is a death, no matter what the way, you know, whatever the form comes. And then post September 11th, going to a lot of the funerals and having to see comrades and the or family members buried due to that. That was really heavy.
Were you in LA on September 11th?
No, I was working at NYPD back then. I would open up on the day. We'd have like maybe one day a week off, and sometimes two every now and then. The day off was never a day off because I would just open the newspaper. It was really bizarre. They would have all the funerals throughout as time went on of everyone who perished in the World Trade Center. And I just kind of look in the paper and then pick someone and then go to a funeral. So it was kind of like an extension of work in a way. So I'd throw the uniform on. So that was pretty heavy stuff. So yeah, I never thought of that. It's like some professions where, yeah, just people don't, you know, friends don't die, comrades don't die, thankfully. And I've had that. So yeah, that is, it's an interesting aspect to think about now I'm speaking about it.
Your norm is not a common norm, sir.
You know, no. Yeah.
Let's get into the last couple of years, conditions over the last couple of years. And I sort of mean political climate, the relationship of the police to maybe the public at large, or maybe specific portions of the public. And one thing, just, you know, visibility between you and I, is I thought about how to have this conversation responsibly and how to have this conversation as a listener and not try to be overly editorial with it. So choices of questions and things, they come from that standpoint, but I kind of already know that you will, but I please want you to be uninhibited in sharing your perception here.
That's the only way I know.
Okay, cool.
For better or worse.
All right. Well, I mean, besides coronavirus, the last couple of years have been largely defined by protest in the streets. The Breonna Taylor, George Floyd influence stuff. A lot of people refer to it as the BLM era.
Sure.
Has that been more difficult than life as usual in your job?
I would say it's been a challenge. I mean, it's a paradigm shift that's definitely upended my profession or the world, I should say. And, you know, I think a lot of things are cyclical. So we're in that social change. You know, I was alive back then, but from what I've read, student of history of like, you know, late 60s, early 70s, you know, the social revolution that was going on around the world. That was influenced by the U.S. and then it moved overseas. I think it propelled us as a better society. Ultimately, it's just painful getting there. It's like starting up a new workout regime. You haven't worked out in 2 or 3 years. Now you're going to work out. And that beginning part is super painful, but it's going to push you into a good, positive space. So I think we're still working out the kinks of the uncomfortable portion of where we need to be in society. So it has to be done in order for the human race to evolve. We're constantly evolving to, you know, get bigger, better, stronger, faster, smarter. So I, for myself, I just see it as a challenge. I see it as a good thing. So
I was going to say, you got there before I asked you, but that almost sounds like in a very complex, very thought out way, you're suggesting that Black Lives Matter is a positive.
Yeah, I mean, I liked what, you know, where it came from organically. Mm-hmm. I understood exactly. I didn't get mad at it. It's kind of unsettling to see how, you know, any organization that's a bunch of humans, someone's going to find a way to make money from it. Someone's going to find it as a side hustle, and then the guy gets kind of corrupted, and which is kind of a bummer. You know, I think it started out with good intentions, and then as it got bigger and bigger, different people got involved in it. And it put a bad name to it. So, but I think just the concept, you don't have to, you know, we get obsessed with organizations itself, but just, you know, the thought of it, I thought it was a good thing of, hey, these people are being marginalized, that's not getting enough attention and resources, and let's do better. I mean, just keep it simple and go from there. So.
Did you find that during that era when the demonstrations in the street were common, that people's ears were maybe a little more closed to you than usual?
Ears close to me. There's a lot of anger, there's a lot of rage, there's a lot of, like I said, disenfranchised people, there's a lot of unstable communities, and we're thrust right in the middle of it. And they don't know me; they just see who I represent. You know, the shield on my uniform, the patch. So I don't take it personal. You know, they're yelling at the institution; they don't know who I am. And I try to connect with at least one person that night or whatever during the riots. And it's like, if I can connect with one person or help them out when they got arrested, it's like, hey, you're under arrest, but you don't have to be a dick about it. I could, look out for you and say, hey, I understand what you're doing. You know, hey, if I was 18 years old, 16 years old, I'd probably be same thing in the streets, kicking up dust and breaking windows. I'm not going to lie. You know, I've done a lot of dumb things as a kid. So I understand. So I just try to put myself in their shoes and see the world from their view, and then just try to make it a decent experience if possible. So I think you can get your job done and just put your ego aside and just, like I said, just try to be kind, but at the same time, if you step to me and my buddies and try to hurt us, you're going to get your world rocked. That's just the bottom line. But once you're done, I'll scrape you off and give you first aid, shake your hand, and then we could be friends after that. It's all good.
That seems to me like a reflexive position it would be impossible not to develop. It seems to me very human. I do not share it, but I can analyze it pretty easily,
Mm-hmm.
I was doing research on this when I knew we'd be discussing these, and I was thinking about the perception versus reality, and my friend Jeff brought up the whole ratio of, good cops to bad cops and this and that, and I started to realize the makeup of the police department in the country, and I went to a few different sources to get this, right? But these appear to be the median stats. The police officers in America, 83% of them are male, okay? That 65% of them are white, and that the average age is 40 years old. Just in terms of perception and the way class is laid out historically in this country, you're going to be fighting an uphill battle to be thought of as anything other than a dominating force. You think that's reasonable?
Sure. Yeah. I mean that's what this country, it's what this country was built on, was male whites, and that's what we got to deal with. That's the feeding pool right now. I mean, it's changing as the country's demographics change. So perception versus reality. I mean, those are the facts, right?
No, those are the facts. And I don't hang them on a police officer because I do not think that you populate the force for the nation. But is that something that you see evolving?
It definitely has been. You know, like traditionally, even though it's white, the vast majority of police department, especially in LA and then New York City, where I'm particularly that I know of factually, it was largely fueled by an immigrant population. So whether it was immigrants of Italians, immigrants of Irish, Polish, Mexican out here, it was always blue collar kids for the most part.
In New York, it goes clear back to Nina, right? There's no Irish need apply for almost any other kind of work.
Right, right. Yeah. So it's been middle to lower class kids. And as that demographic changes and we get the influx of the new people coming from overseas, and that has been changing in the New York City Police Department and Los Angeles Police Department. So it's an interesting thing as that perception changes. But then it's funny when you tell, I've seen it on Twitter, which is like an alternate universe with that people love to, throw out their version of facts. But when you present like actual numbers, like in particular with LAPD, when you tell people that it's actually a majority minority police department right now, it rocks the world. They don't get it. But then they'll take it and say, well, that they're still part of the systemic racism and everything else they'll throw at you. Like, no matter what, you can't win, no matter who's in charge of the police department. Oh, they're brainwashed, or this and that. And so you just got to, shrug your shoulders and just move on. I don't know. The whole obsession with race thing is it's an interesting thing that's going on. And I just wish it wasn't as a big divider as it is in this country. I think we got bigger problems than that going on that we have to look for, that we have to look at right now. I mean, it's definitely a problem, but I think we could solve that. And it is little by little.
I don't necessarily think you're wrong. I do think doing this interview, having the opportunity to talk to you and doing it in the year that we're doing it, if I were to look back 10 years from now and not have brought up race, I'd be kicking.
Sure.
It just doesn't seem like a realistic thing to avoid in this conversation. I got really caught up a couple of years ago and wrote some songs about sort of the militarization of the police force. This was during the riots in Missouri and everything else, sort of looking at a lot of police forces, particularly in, you know, middle American states buying up military surplus. I don't expect you to have an opinion on that. I don't expect you to have influenced that practice, but it made me think about something I heard in another podcast in a comparison I'd appreciate if you could share with the listeners, which is, you said it's very different policing in New York and policing in California by virtue of sort of resources versus methodology. In other words, what's available to you on one coast, what's necessary on the other coast are two very different things. You kind of know what I'm referring to?
Like styles of policing?
Yeah, I heard you literally say that you have to do, a lot more by doing or by force when you have smaller numbers and when you have less money available to you, and that was illustrated by working on the opposite coasts.
Sure. I mean, that's a big issue right now is police hiring and retention and recruitment. I think the more police you have available on the street, it's like NYPD versus LAPD. It's what I know is LAPD was more, it's gotten away from it a lot, but it was more the officer to citizen ratio was, the gap was huge. So they had to rule the streets by intimidation, force, and being proactive. And in New York City, it was the complete opposite. They had more people out there, more resources, so they didn't have to put the clamp down on people like they did out here. It's kind of like the father that's divorced. He has to be super nice on the weekends to the kid. And if he was just there every day, he just could be a regular dad. And he doesn't have to be overbearing with his love, like, you know, pouring out, you know, let's do this, let's do that, giving him ice cream. Like, no, if you're there every day, you could just be a regular dad. If you're not there every day, you got to be abnormal in some type of way. So if you have enough police on the street, you know, people are comfortable with you. You're comfortable with them. You don't have to rule by force and fear, which I think that's the wrong way to go about doing things. So, but that's what it was, just, you know, the mother of necessity. I had to go out in LA. They had to go out there and be proactive and shake the bushes to put that fear into people where, hey, we're not out here all the time, but we're going to be looking for you. And if you're doing something wrong, we're going to bring it. And right or wrong, it got things done. But then you look at the effect it has. The relations were horrendous out in the streets. And it really turned a lot of people off, and a lot of communities got the short end of that stick, literally, and wasn't the best thing. So I think the best way is just being present, having more people out there and solving issues where you don't have to come down with an iron fist.
When I told some people I was going to be doing this interview, it was interesting. One friend of mine from Texas immediately was able to pick you out by name and by description from the Netflix series, from the crime scene, the vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. I'm not going to ask you about that, although I know it was a big hit and I watched it. I got to do the hey, I know that dude thing. But what I was thinking is you're media friendly. In other words, you've been on camera, you know, you've been a resource for things like that. You do a fair number of podcasts. You have a podcast of your own, and you are talking to me now. And in my case, in particular, you're talking to a dirty leftist punker. and I'm thinking to myself, is there a sensitivity in your job? Is there a strict set of parameters? Is there a heightened sensitivity to sharing your opinions in spaces like this? Or is it just natural where you stand and your perspective is not a threat to the job, you know? It seems to be trippy how free you are with your speech. And I'm sort of curious how that works.
You know what? It's really not something that's condoned or encouraged. You know, yeah. It's never, if someone does something in my profession, does something, retires from the job and does something bad 50 years down the road, it's not just, you know, Jim McSorley committed whatever crime. It's like retired cop, ex-cop does XYZ. So you're always the face of the organization. So since we do have a lot of rebels and some wild men out there, talking to the press and talking on podcasts is definitely not encouraged. But I've been able to successfully navigate the field. I can't talk for my agency per se. You know, mm-hmm. I'm only allowed to say that I'm a, you know, police detective in Los Angeles, and you figure out the rest. Mm-hmm. And but I've. I guess, you know, my opinions or whatever, and, you know, where I come from, I always try to come from a place of love, a place of compassion, and a place of learning. So I'm not going to talk about wild, crazy shit, you know, conspiracy theories or whatever stuff that's going to bring negative attention to my agency. Mm-hmm. But for, you know, there are some guys that will talk crazy, and that's why we have these rules in our organization, because they, no matter what, it'll they're speaking on behalf of law enforcement. So there you go. I mean, there was some guys at the January 6th caper that went down. So that got a lot of press of just being there. You're not even within the riot itself, just being present at a demonstration, you know, whatever it is, whatever you want to label it, but whatever your opinion is on it, just standing on that ground and doing absolutely nothing, you're immediately a target. So you lose your rights when you join the police department of speech, being present at certain activities, associations with people. You can't associate with ex-cons. Could have been someone that committed one crime 50 years ago, and now they're a priest. You can't associate with that person.
So that's interesting to me. I always pictured there being police sort of reformation case relationships. I guess not.
I know. It's a really...
Television lied to me.
Yeah. It's an interesting profession where you're given a lot of freedom or a lot of power, but then a lot of that power is taken back from you.
Okay.
So...
Well, I want you to know that I thank you for a very forthcoming conversation. I couldn't help but have anxiety about this, even though we know each other, because they just seem to me like difficult things to talk about. No, both the experiences and the perspectives regarding sort of certain hot button things. I promised a friend of mine I would ask you this. McSorley's Ale House on the East Side in New York, is there any family connection, or is it just a beloved institution?
Way back when there was, but it was sold by the McSorley's to a great, great family, the Mars, who I'm very, very close with, and great, great people, fabulous institution. Have you been?
No, and he was sort of making fun of me for that because I've both been to New York and I'm a, you know, I'm a publican. I run bars.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Yes.
But so you are, though, you are those McSorley's, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad I asked.
Yep. Everyone's from Derry, so it's a real small clan. And of course, you know, it's like every Irishman has, you know, a couple of dreams, right? It's to own a bar, uh-huh. You know, write a book. Check. And what else? Is there anything else? No, right? So you got two out of two. So you're living out dream, my man.
Okay, and you got
records.
There it is.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, Nako, this was fun. This was edifying. This was everything I hoped it would be. So thank you very much.
No, thank you. Pleasure's mine. And I look up to you as an outspoken person. Your literature is bar none. Your music has been inspiring. So I just love your work. And I hope you have a lot more in the can. And get back out there live and start putting out some records, my man.
Doing my best, sir. I'm doing my best. All right. Well, listen, everybody, that is episode 51 of Dano Says So. Take care.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.